guys hear me okay? All right. Good evening. My name is Chris. I'm an alcoholic. And I want to start by thanking you all for asking me to come share time with you here over the next few weeks. It's always an honor and a privilege to be asked to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've had the opportunity to do some really, really cool things in AA since I came here on July 7th of 2015. But this has probably got to be top of the list. And it's because the experience I've had with this book, with a sponsor, and with members in my home group has been what saved my life. You know, I would definitely be drunk and most likely dead if I did not have that experience with this book. It's just what had happened for me. And I was thinking a lot about that, and I understand that a lot of times, and I've listened to some of the other speakers who have come here, there are, you know, themes or ideas that they have in mind when they come and they speak. And, you know, one of the things that I've been thinking a lot about and that I've talked with my sponsor a lot about lately is the ideas of desperation, inspiration, and perpetuation, right? Because I was kind of told that those become building blocks that help me with the willingness to continue forward in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, what I mean by that is the desperation that I'm going to talk a little bit about tonight that helped me when I came in to propel me through steps 1, 2, and 3. You know, and then the inspiration that I found in myself and working with others in steps 4 through 9. And the perpetuation in steps 10 through 12 of the basically meaning continuation of this thing in Alcoholics Anonymous and the continuation of my sobriety and carrying the message and doing my best to help others. And so that's kind of what I was thinking about when we go through that. So tonight I'm going to talk a little bit about the desperation that I've had that helped me through 1, 2, and 3. And, you know, the funny thing about it is when I get asked to do any commitment, and this one in particular, my first reaction is I'm flattered and I'm excited, right? And then a couple weeks go by and we get closer to the date and I'm not as flattered. And I'm still excited, but I'm trying to decide if it's excitement or fear or intimidation, and I can't really have it nailed down each one. I haven't nailed down yet. But the reason being is because when you're asked to come and share an experience that you've had with something that I hold in such high regard as the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, my fear is that I'm going to sound like I'm preaching, right? Or my fear is that I'm going to sound like I'm telling everybody how it is, and that's not the case. You know, to come off that way to me feels quite arrogant, and that is what I get concerned about, right? So I have to remember that all I'm sharing about is my experience with this book and the experience that I've had reading it with a sponsor and people in my home group. And I've mentioned my sponsor, and I'll mention them a few more times, but I do have a sponsor. He is well aware that he is my sponsor, and not just because I talked to him about this commitment 7,000 times before I came here, but he is aware he's my sponsor because I've called him every single day since my second day in Alcoholics Anonymous. And because we are active in our home group, which is the By the Book group of Atlantic Highlands, as Mark mentioned earlier. You know, and I've had my own experience, and I've done that by standing on the shoulders of the people in my home group who reached down and pulled me up and taught me that my alcoholism is not necessarily unique, but the experience that I have and the experiences that I have or will have are going to be somewhat unique, and that at the end of the day, the only thing that we have to share is our story and our experience. And so that's what I'm hoping is going to come through when I share that. And, you know, the other interesting thing I was going to share before we get started is I think sometimes it might be good when I've done commitments like this is to give a baseline of how I came to find the Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, because in my experience, I was exposed to the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous way before I had an experience with it. You know, because if you think about exposure, it means to maybe be around something or physically touch it, you know, or be aware of it or something like that. To have an experience means, in my opinion, to have learned something from it, right? Or to have worked at something, or to have immersed yourself in it, to have some sort of experience that you take away from. And so I'll share briefly about that before we jump in here, but you know, my exposure to the Big Book came at a, I guess, fairly young age. I come from a family of alcoholics. Some are, some are not, right? That's how it goes. And so I come from a family of alcoholics. I have family members that I've lost from alcoholism, And I have one family member who has gotten sober and stayed sober, and she's an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's my mom, and she's been sober 26 years. And that's not a thing I always like sharing at meetings, because I don't want to tell people that my mommy helped get me sober, because I think it lowers my street cred. And, you know, the funny thing is, as I say, that's my experience, right? And I know a lot of people, including a friend of mine here tonight, who have had a very similar experience. And if I don't stay true to my experience, then really what am I doing? So the interesting thing about that is I started drinking at the age of 14 almost exactly the day when my mom went to rehab. It's almost like a handing of the baton. And, you know, she went off to that rehab and she came back and she went to Alcoholics Anonymous immediately because that's what they told her to do. So all I knew at that point in time when I was around 14 and 15 when my drinking began is that mom wasn't drinking anymore and that life was getting a little bit better and that there was no longer alcohol in the house, which I didn't like because I had just started drinking. But I also, you know, I'd like to be able to say that I was one of the really, really supportive children of an alcoholic, but I wasn't, because I was happy that things were getting better, but I wasn't the kid who was there at celebrations. I wasn't doing all those things. I was, well, I'm an alcoholic. I was selfish, right? So the only things I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous was I knew that mom went to meetings. I knew that there were new people around and they seemed pretty nice, you know. I knew that she had a whole host of new friends. And I knew that at some of these meetings, they read from this thing called the Big Book, which at the time, I just assumed was one very large book that you had that was up in the front of the room and that one person went up to and read from. Basically very similar to how the priest at my church would read from the Bible in church when I was a kid. That's the only real baseline that I had. And that's all I knew about this Big Book that they had in Alcoholics Anonymous. And my drinking progressed pretty quickly, and I became an everyday drinker. I became a blackout drinker. You know, I became somebody who, and we'll talk about the allergy in a little bit, but I became somebody who at some point crossed the line, and by the time I got here, I was finally desperate enough. I was shaking, and I was yellow, and I was sick, and I was going to die. It didn't happen like that immediately, but it happened over time. You know, what started to happen to me is I started to find myself in a lot of different places, like psych wards and hospitals and detoxes and rehabs, and every once in a while they'd bring a meeting in here and there. But the first time I was that had any exposure to the Big Book truly was in 2010 when I went to a rehab. I was on a hot streak. I was 5 months off of nearly dying on Christmas Day from alcohol poisoning, and it seemed like getting out of Dodge was a good idea. So I went down to a rehab in Florida, and I landed at this rehab in Florida. And they tell you things like, take it easy, get settled in. And then they handed me a Big Book. And I found it really interesting because, number one, I was like, I thought there was only one book, like you guys read from. I didn't know everyone got their own. And the other was they gave me the softcover one, so not even as large as the hardcover one. So I was like, these people are really upside down if they think this is a big book. And it wasn't even as thick as some of the books that they tried to make me read in high school and college. So, you know, I was pretty confused, but what I interpreted that as when they handed me that book in that rehab was, if I give them the impression like I've read this book, then they are going to let me out. And so I would sit outside in the Florida sun, and I would smoke my cigarettes, and I would hold this book on my lap, and every time one of the counselors walked by, I would open the page up, you know, and I would pretend like I was reading it. And then when they walked by again later, I'd open it a little further and pretend like I was reading it, and I'd nod my head, you know, because I heard that, like, you're supposed to identify. So I'd be like, everyone come watch me identify with this book, you know. And so, you know, I didn't read it, but I saw words, right? I saw things like phenomenon of craving. I saw words like jaywalker, right? I saw words like milk and whiskey, and I was like, well, I don't drink milk and whiskey. I don't need to be here. You know, I saw things like, oh, they have a doctor writing this stuff? What's going on here? You know, and that for me was fundamentally the difference, right? It wasn't until I read this book with somebody else who had an experience and had depth and weight with it that I actually was able to grasp and develop some sort of understanding, even in the mildest way, because I was not doing that at that point in my life. Now, funny thing that happened is I'm in that rehab, and there's a guy there who is a nice guy for all intents and purposes, and all I knew about him is every morning he got up early and he sat outside at a table with four other guys and they read this book, and I avoided them, right? Because I did not want to get sober. I was not desperate enough. I was not hurting enough, right? And so I would avoid them. And one day we're in the white van coming back from a meeting, and he hands me the book and he says, I just want you to read this one page. And he has me read the first page of A Vision for You. And I read it and I closed it and I politely thanked him and I handed it back to him and I said, that's a book I'll never open again because that described me perfectly. And from there, I was just not going to open that book ever again. And I had my grand plan of speed reading this book or giving the impression of it and getting out of there in 28 days, and they kept me for 45. And they dropped me off at the airport, and they sent me on my way, book in my hand, off to go enjoy my new sober life, and I get into the airport, and I'm drunk within the first 30 minutes. You know, and everyone knows that feeling, right? We are defenseless against the first drink. And that's how I was. And I came back home, and I just caused more havoc, right? I don't need to go into a very long story about that, but I caused more havoc. I actually grew up not too far from this area. At one point, I had the grand plan of flunking out of rehab and living in my mom's basement in Mountainside and drinking there the rest of my life, and she's just not going to find out, right? And she's in AA for like 15 years at that point, so you all know how that story goes. And I find myself without anywhere else to go, and 3 months after I'm out of that rehab, I'm actually riding my bicycle drunk down Route 22 in Union right here. And, the interesting thing about that is in those years from 2010 until 2015 when I came in and actually started to read this book, I slept in a lot of different places. None of them were really a home, but I slept in a lot of different places. And that little book they gave me in that rehab was always on some sort of shelf. And I never really understood why, but it followed me. And I'd stare at it when I was drinking. And I think it's because I knew that the solution was in there. But I didn't have any intention of finding the solution because I just wasn't hurting enough. And on July 7th of 2015, I was in a lot of pain. And I found myself in the hospital again and getting out of the hospital and going to a church basement in Atlantic Highlands on a Tuesday night for a big book study. And I go down there and I go to meet a guy who I was referred to, right? The AA phone chain. When you reach out and say, I need some help, and they call everybody and the cavalry comes. And they bring me over and they sit me down next to this guy, Drew, who would become my sponsor. And he looks at me and he says, what's going on? And I said to him, I can't stop drinking. I need to stop drinking. I don't know what to do, but I know I'm going to die. And that was the moment where I knew I had enough desperation. And he looked at me and he said, well, that is awesome. And I thought maybe they sat me next to somebody with less time than me somehow. And he looked me dead in the eye and he said, we have this book, we have these steps, we have this people, we have this program. You don't need to know what to do. You just do what we do and you're going to be okay. And I don't remember a whole lot about what happened in that meeting. But after that meeting, I was in pretty bad shape and there were some guys there who wanted to send me to the hospital. And I showed them my hospital band. And I said, I just came from the hospital, and I've been at the hospital a lot of times. There's no more help for me there. And they said, okay. And that guy walked over to a table just like that one, and he grabbed this exact book, and he wrote something in it, and he handed it to me. And I thought it was going to be a Bible passage or some other religious cult type of thing that I could allow to chase me out of AA. And he simply wrote his full name and his phone number, which I won't read, but he did write, precise, clear-cut directions, prayers, promises, and warnings. Good luck, and let us help you trudge the road. And it's hard not to cry every single time I read it because it's the exact moment where my desperation kicked in and I started to have an experience with this book. And so that's what I'm going to talk a little bit about tonight in that desperation, and we're going to get into it here. The main thing that I'll say about me when I'm going to talk about step one first, the main thing for me with step one is that I had no problem admitting that I was powerless over alcohol, right? I would buy those shooters of alcohol, those little airplane bottles. I was talking about them with a friend of mine who's a similar type of drinker. And I would buy those because that was the way that I was going to control my drinking. And I would buy only, this is going to sound funny, I'd buy only 12 of them. And I knew it before I said it. And so I was like, I'm only going to buy 12 of them, right? So I'm buying them by the sleeve. And that's how I'm going to control it. And I'd get down, I'd get down in my little apartment and I'd start drinking them and I'd get halfway through and it's on, right? I'm powerless over it. I know that I can't stop when I get to 12 and I'm already at 6 and now it's decision time, right? Do I drive drunk now or do I drive really drunk later? And so there I am, walking to my car, crying the entire time I'm walking there because I know that I'm experiencing powerlessness. I'm steeped in that. Right? And so when I came in, I said, I have no problem with powerlessness. That's fine. You know, I understand my life is unmanageable. And there's been times, and even recently, where I've said that a lot of AA started for me at step two. And I think that that's sometimes wrong when I say that. You know, because I understood that I was powerless, but I had to really understand why I was powerless. And I had to understand what powerlessness meant. You know, and that's where I started to learn about that. And that's one of the first things I'm going to read here in the book is going to be in the doctor's opinion on XXVI. And I'll try to remember to call out the page numbers because I know you're following along. On XXVI, at the bottom of the page, starting with the second to last paragraph, it says, the doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little, but as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. That was the first time that I was told that I have an allergy to alcohol, and that did interest me. Right, I looked up what the word allergy meant, and I have it here. It says a damaging immune response, right, which is pretty spot on. You know, I kept saying to myself, okay, I'm powerless over it, but why? And that's where I was told, it's because you have this allergy. Right, now I'm going to find out a little bit more about why I'm powerless in a little bit here, because my first reaction is, when I was a kid, I was told that I was allergic to chocolate. Now, I still ate it anyways, and I still got very sick because I liked the effect it produced. I liked the sugar. I liked the taste. I also found out that I had a mild peanut allergy, right? I didn't like the way those things tasted anyway, so I was like, no problem. Won't eat them, right? So then why, when I have this allergy to alcohol, can I not seem to stay away from it even though it's hurting me tremendously? So I knew that there had to be something there that was causing this for me. You know, and the thing that really helped me kind of buy into the idea of this allergy is in the middle of the next page, it starts out with we doctors, and it says, we doctors have realized for a long time that some form of moral psychology was of urgent importance to alcoholics, but its application presented difficulties beyond our conception. What with our ultra-modern standards, our scientific approach to everything, we are perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of good that lie outside our synthetic knowledge. So the reason I started to buy into this idea of that allergy is because, as I was told, like, if you think about doctors, especially even at that time, it must have been really, really hard for this doctor in particular, and I know it was not necessarily the popular opinion at the time at the very first printing, but it must have been very hard as a doctor to say, we don't have the answer, right? I mean, this is, you know, this is a time where they're only like 5 to 10 years removed from discovering something like penicillin, right? Doctors are on top of the world, right? They're discovering things when he says ultra-modern standards. Like, I mean, you've got things like insulin and vitamins and other things that are being discovered right around that time in the world, right? So doctors have got to be thinking like, this is something we can solve. And they've got this doctor saying, we can't solve this. You've got an allergy, but we can't solve this thing. And that caught my attention and said, okay, then what is it, right? Why is this allergy happening? What is it that's causing it to me? You know, and what do I do to stop it? You know, and I'll just share quickly on the next page. You know, it talks a little bit about, first full paragraph on that page, we believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is listed to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. The allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. And once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. And the phenomenon of craving is something I could identify with. Because when I start drinking, and I'm in an environment where I can't drink by myself as much and as fast as I want, and I'm maybe sitting around a table with a bunch of people and I start to have a drink, all of a sudden, I start to notice that I have a lot less of my drink left, they have a lot more left, and my knee starts bouncing, right? My knee starts bouncing, I'm tapping on the chair, and what I'm really doing is I'm trying to do the logistics in my head of how I get the next drink without anyone knowing. And what I've come to find out is that normal people, normal drinkers, that doesn't happen to them. You know, my wife is not an alcoholic. She'll drink half a glass of wine, and we'll be driving home from the restaurant, and I'll be like, "You all right? Like, you feeling anxious? Like, do you need anything?" She's like, "I just want to go home and go to bed." You know, like, and it's like I'm watching something on the Discovery Channel, because I can't understand this other species that I'm living with. And, you know, that's the part where I know, like, I have this thing. And I remember I was told to write this down, the words, "I'm doomed," because it's true. And they say it further on in here, but I was told to write that down. I am doomed, right? Family, friends, loved ones, people that I truly, deeply care about begging me to stop, and I cannot, and I don't know why, right? And it's because the moment that I take that drink, as simple as the sip of water that I just took, no matter how small it is, it's on, and it starts. The process has begun. I have already lost the fight before I'm even in any pain or before I even know it. And so I hung on to that, and I said, okay, this phenomenon of craving thing, you know, I'm like, you guys might be onto something. You know, it might be real here. And I'll get into the next page here. At the very bottom, it says, all these and many others have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing this phenomenon of craving. The phenomenon, as we have suggested, may be the manifestation of an allergy, which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. It has never been any treatment with which we are familiar permanently eradicated. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. So now you're telling me that I just can't drink anymore? Right? I'm like, that's the, you know, in my mind. Now, mind you, I showed up here very, very sick, right? But then you tell me complete abstinence, and I want to tell you that the only thing I'm good at is drinking, right? Meanwhile, I'm nearly dying when I show up here, and I'm like, but I'm good at drinking, you know? And that's going to get into some of the things we're going to talk about in a minute about the mental effect it has. But this showed me really how I became powerless, right? This is why, I don't, for whatever reason, when I read this, it makes me think of the idea that we can all be so different in terms of personalities and, you know, any other type of characteristic or demographic you want to use, but we can all be so different. But the thing that unites us all is that we all have this thing that happens in this paragraph. And that also made me feel incredibly good, because I didn't feel so darn alone. You know, when I sat and read this with somebody else, and I shared that story about the knee bouncing and how am I going to do this and how am I going to do that, you know, two things happened. Number one, everybody else agreed with me, right? It's really three things. Because number two, I felt so much better that everyone else agreed with me, because I didn't feel so alone. And then number three, I started to get a little resentful, because I was like, what do you mean? I'm really a bad alcoholic, you know, that sort of thing. You know, I'm the worst one you've ever had. And then I find out that, you know, maybe I'm just a garden variety drunk like the rest of everybody, and I should just keep reading with my friends here and learn a little bit. And I'm going to jump ahead here a little bit. We're going to jump ahead into page 21, and there is a solution. Because I talked about, you know, the powerlessness and how did I become powerless. And this is where they're talking about the description, normal drinkers and real alcoholics. And it's going to start with the paragraph of what about the real alcoholic? He may start off as a moderate drinker. He may or may not become a continuous hard drinker. But at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control and his liquor consumption once he starts to drink. So I try not to spend too much time trying to identify where the line was that I crossed. But I can fall prey to that, right? I can fall prey to sitting, right? When I have too much time on my hands, and most likely when I'm alone, I can spend a lot of time trying to figure out where the line was. Because my drinking when I started out in high school wasn't an everyday thing. I knew I felt better when I drank, but it wasn't an everyday thing, you know? In fact, it didn't have to be like an every other day thing. You know, it really just didn't happen like that, right? And then I got to college and I would drink, but then I wouldn't drink sometimes. And, you know, I couldn't understand where the line was. And I, you know, at some point I just woke up one day and realized I've drank every single day for a pretty long time now. Mm-hmm. You know? And then all of a sudden there are some things like the suddenly the thought crossed my mind moments that we read about in this book where All of a sudden, one day, I was having a really rough day. It was like 11 a.m. on a Saturday. And I had an argument with somebody. And suddenly the thought crossed my mind, well, why are you waiting until 6 o'clock to drink? Why don't you just drink right now? You know? And I think I was over the line when that happened already. But I think of these moments where... the way I think of it is, I think of it as moments where my alcoholism made a power move, right? Where it saw an opportunity and it jumped a few steps up, right? Rather than sometimes as the subtle foe it is, going up slowly and progressing, it saw an opportunity and it just took me from level 5 to level 9, right? And that's exactly how it happened in some of those. And the other interesting thing when they talk about this is I lose all control of liquor consumption once I start to drink. I can't tell you how many times I would go out somewhere and say, I'm not going to drink. Or tonight I'm just going to drink beer, right? Or tonight I'm just going to drink this or that. Or, you know, whatever, any other combination. We could spend a lot of time here talking about different combinations of things that we've tried. But every single time, once I had that first drink, it was, it's all going to be okay. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've blacked out quite a bit in my life. And so I would go out to places and I know when I start drinking, like, I'd be a few drinks in and I'd think, like, is this going to be the one where the lights go off? And that scared me. It scared me a lot, but not enough to not get that next drink. I'd always just roll the dice, you know? And that part where they talk about I lose all control of liquor consumption once I start to drink, you know? And at that point in my life, I had some people, you know, through a family member who was sober, who was trying to get people to talk some sense into me a little bit, you know? They'd say, hey, we're a little worried about your drinking, and one of the things that they said to me was, be careful because the first drink gets you drunk. And as an active alcoholic with no interest in getting sober, I was like, you're out of your mind. I'm like, it's not the first drink that gets me drunk. I'm like, I'm in the process of trying to figure out which drink it is that gets me drunk. I'm like, and I'll let you know when I solve that. But you know, it's not the first one. And, you know, and that's where I read this and I remember being like, man, I owe an apology to a few people because I mocked them when they would tell me those types of things. But I continued drinking. You know, the thing here, and this is the one that I really want to get to at step one, is on page 23. I'll read the paragraph, but I'm going to slow down at the part that I was told to circle and underline. It's the first paragraph there. These observations would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. And here's the part that I was really told about. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body. So that's when I was like, you mean it's not just physical? I'm like, so I can't just not drink, right? That's where there's these moments that I call them moments that catch my attention in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? And that was one of them because my sponsor said, yeah, like we removed the alcohol thing from you, but your powerlessness centers in your mind. Your unmanageability centers in your mind. And that made me more desperate because I thought maybe if I could just physically remove the alcohol, that'd be okay. But if you tell me that my mind's the problem, I'm in a lot of fear because I know my mind is messed up. I've known my head has been messed up since I was a kid and 7 years old, and my earliest memory is obsessing what people think about me. Right? So when you tell me that my problem centers in my mind, I think there is absolutely no way I have any shot. Right? Now, what I don't realize in that moment is that at least in my case, my understanding of the fact that my powerlessness centers in my mind is the way that I start to become opened up to the ideas that I'm going to have to get on board with in steps 2 and 3, right? And for me, the desperation of knowing that the powerlessness centers in my mind really is just the thing that got me on board. And I'm going to do a couple more things on one here, and I'm going to jump a little bit ahead, and then we're going to go into 2 and 3, but I just want to read in more about alcoholism on page 30, second full paragraph. It says, we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic. This is the first step in recovery. I mean, I don't know if anyone else has heard this as a meeting, but this phrase, thank God for good sponsorship, because it's nestled in there and easy for me to move over it or cursory, you know, pass it by. if I'm reading this thing on my own and not with somebody who has an understanding of it, right? We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. That's step one. I have to fully concede to my innermost self that I'm an alcoholic. Now, we also use the term armed with the facts about ourselves. And I think that we are fully armed with the facts about ourselves as we get into more of the steps, right, that we go through here. But at this point in AA, I am now armed with the fact about myself that I am powerless over alcohol, that I have the phenomenon of craving and the physical obsession, but now I'm also finding out that the main problem of my alcoholism centers in my mind. And I know that that is not a problem that I can solve on my own. When my mind is the problem, I can't think my way out of it because I'm already sitting in the problem. And that's where I was like, okay, then that means that there's more coming here. And the final thing that I'll say here is going to be on page 41 and more about alcoholism. On step one is going to be the last paragraph. Starts in the italics. It says, not only had I been off guard, I had made no fight whatever against the first drink. This time I had not thought of the consequences at all. I had commenced to drink carelessly as though the cocktails were ginger ale. That brought up enough memories in me for me to say, I can't get out of this thing. I have a serious problem. I cannot think my way through this. I cannot solve this on my own. And then I start to go to people like my sponsor and I said to my sponsor, thank you for keeping me sober. You know, I was 14 days sober. I was in that same meeting that I showed up the 14 days ago on that Tuesday. And I'm in this meeting. I haven't had a drink in 2 weeks and I'm crying my eyes out. My sponsor looks at me and says, are you okay? And he's probably thinking I'm going to tell him I relapsed because I'm just bawling my eyes out at the end of this meeting while everyone's trying to pray and I'm sobbing, you know. And I said, I just can't get over the idea that I haven't had a drink in 14 days. And I said, you know, that's every day of the week, twice in a row. And he laughed at me and he calmed me down and I just kept saying, thank you for keeping me sober, thank you for keeping me sober. And he looked at me and he said, listen, kid, I really appreciate you saying that. I do. He goes, but I don't want you to ever thank me again. He goes, you need to thank God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous because at some point in your life, the only thing between you and a drink is going to be your relationship with a higher power. And I said, okay, well, then how do we do that? You know? Because if you're telling me that I need to, you know, come up with a relationship with a higher power or believe in a higher power at all, then, you know, I don't even know where to start. And that's where he and I started on step two and three. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about those. And I know we're going to be jumping around here in the book, so I'll call out the page numbers. But I just want to hit on page 19, and there is a solution. It does say here at the top, we feel that elimination of our drinking is but a beginning. A much more important demonstrations of our principles lies before us in our respective homes, occupations, and affairs. So now you're also telling me that I'm going to have to do more work and that I'm also going to have to do it not just in the room for 1 hour. Like, you mean like I, you know, you hear people say like, well, you can't be a saint here and go home and be the devil to your family, you know? So that's where I said, okay, well, I'm not really sure how you expect me to find that. And that's where we start to get into finding and believing in two and three. On page 24, it's the last paragraph. When this sort of drinking is fully established in an individual with alcoholic tendencies, he has probably placed himself beyond human aid. So I was, you know, instructed the moment I read that, circle that, underline it, double underline it, two colors highlighter, all that kind of stuff, right? He's placed himself beyond human aid, and unless locked up, may die or go permanently insane. So that's where they start to tell me the same thing my sponsor told me, right? As a human individual, I'm not the person who is going to get and keep you sober. It's going to have to come from a power greater than yourself, right? And that's where I said, okay. And then it said the thing about the insanity, and I was like, I know I'm insane. I mean, I lived by myself for the last 5 years of my drinking, and I was constantly hearing voices, things that weren't there. I had a hard time determining if something that happened was something I actually did or if it was something that I just, you know, kind of dreamt up or thought about when I was like half drunk or blacked out. And then, you know, at the top of the next page on 25, it says, it talks about how there is a solution. And then it says, but we saw that it really worked in others, and we had to come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life we had been living it. Right? So I have to be completely and utterly hopeless and desperate like I was in order to be willing to believe in a power greater than myself. It goes on to say, the great fact is just this and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences. And I said, okay, this is when you guys are going to drop religion on me. You know? And that's when they started to tell me it's not about religion, right? It's about a spiritual experience. And we read that appendix on spiritual experience. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but what it amounted to is that I found out that I was in luck. I found out that my spiritual experience was not going to have to be a white light moment, like my sponsor and I had read in Bill's story, because the only thing crazier than drinking myself to death would be the idea of some sort of white light moment or lightning bolt hitting me. I mean, I was walking around thinking that I was just waiting to get struck by God, you know, and I was freaked out about that, to say, you know, to put it bluntly. And we read about that, and we read that, you know, spiritual experiences, as mine have been, have come in the form of the educational variety, right? They come slowly over time, and they come in the little things, the profound alteration in our reactions to life. Those types of things. And I said, okay, I can get on board with the idea that those things could happen for me. And they said, okay, well, that's where you're going to have to start building a relationship and believing in a higher power. And there's one other line on here that I'll say. I'm not going to read the whole paragraph, but it is the last paragraph on the page where it says, if you are seriously alcoholic as we were, we believe there is no middle-of-the-road solution. When I was very early in sobriety, I went and saw a guy speak who's become a good friend of mine now, and he stood up there at that podium, and he said, we will die in the middle of the road. And he said it with such conviction that I believed it, and I felt it, like, in my bones. You know, and I said, he's right. We're, you know, if I'm either going forward or I'm going backwards. Like, I'm not standing still. So now I'm going to have to go and do these other things that you guys are telling me. And, you know, as it gets in here, I'm going to go ahead to a couple pages in the interest of time. But one of the things it says on here in More About Alcoholism, on page 33, I had now been presented with the idea, and I'm not reading, I'm just telling you where I'm at, but at that time I had been presented with the idea that I was going to have to believe in a power greater than myself to restore me to sanity, right? And then I was going to have to turn my will over to a care of God as I understood him. And I was like, well, how do I know if I'm going to do that, right? How do I know that I'm ready to do that? Or how do I know that it has happened? And it was repeated to me in here. At the bottom of the page, it just says there can be no reservation of any kind or any lurking notion that someday we will be immune to alcohol. And they said, are you still on board with that? And I said, yeah. And they said, well, then you're going to have to believe in a power greater than yourself restoring you to sanity. And, you know, I'm going to talk a little bit about 2 and 3 here, but the summary of how those things happened for me is I went into it with a mindset of, I'm just going to believe. Like, I'm so desperate that I just have to believe. You know, for any baseball fans, there was a Mets team in the 80s, and their theme was, you gotta believe. That was their slogan. And my father was a big Mets fan, and I remember he had t-shirts with it. And that's all I thought about when they told me about Came to Believe. I just thought, you gotta believe. You know, you gotta believe. And that's how I felt, because I knew I had no other option. I was desperate enough to adopt what they were saying. So then I was taken to page 39, where I had the paragraph at the top. It says, that may be true of certain non-alcoholic people who, though drinking foolishly and heavily at the present time, are able to stop or moderate because their brains and bodies have not been damaged, as our word. So I know I'm past that. But the actual potential alcoholic, with hardly an exception, will be absolutely unable to stop drinking on the basis of self-knowledge. So then I was reminded again to underline that, because they said, are you once again good with the idea that you're not going to think your way out of this? And I said, okay, no problem. I'm going to be okay with that. But I need you guys to show me how I'm going to start to seek this out. Now, one of the main things that helped me here is going to be on page 43 and More About Alcoholism. So, and we talked about this. Once more, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink, except in a few rare cases. Neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power. So early in my sobriety, I was trying to figure out, like, if I'm told to have no mental defense against the first drink, like, well, how do you stop an attack that you don't know is coming, right? And I was told, well, do you believe? Yes, I believe. Okay, are you going to turn your will over to a guy who understands them? Yes. And there, I said, well, what do I do that? And they said, well, start praying and start developing a relationship with a power greater than yourself. And I had something happen to me early in sobriety where I was tested with that. I was in this process of working, you know, 2 and 3 here, and I had to go on a trip for work, and I couldn't get out of it. Early in my sobriety, I did my best to not travel for work because I just didn't want to do that. I mean, I'm a guy who drank airplane bottles at home, right? Like, you're going to put me on an airplane and give me airplane bottles? Like, I'm a perfect fit for that. So, you know, the thing is like, I just couldn't get out of the trip, right? So I find myself in Pittsburgh. I'm about 30 days sober, 14 days removed from that conversation with my sponsor where he told me I was going to have a higher power between me and a drink, and I'm trying to understand this concept of God and the fact that I am walking around defenseless unless I am working on developing this relationship. And I'm in a hotel in Pittsburgh, and we're about to go actually to a baseball game, and I'm walking towards the elevator, and I'm waiting for the elevator to come. And I'm, you know, in those hotels by the elevators, they always have mirrors, which I think are basically so you can check yourself out to see how you look before you get on the elevator. Like, I mean, don't pretend like you guys haven't done it. So I'm standing and looking in this elevator, and I'm thinking to myself, I could just go drink tonight. You know? I could just be drunk in Pittsburgh and sober in New Jersey. Like, that's totally fine. And nobody has to know. And I can go have a few drinks. And it popped in my head. This is the defenseless moment they were telling me about. And then the second thing that popped in my head is when my sponsor said to me, the only thing between you and a drink is going to be your higher power. And I turned around and, you know, there's not like a whole lot of things I can very clearly remember in my first 30 or 60 days of sobriety. But I remember what I was wearing that night. I remember what the floor felt like beneath my feet when I walked away from that elevator and into that hotel room. And I got on my knees and I actually said, hey, God, I know we don't know each other very well at this point. I said, but just not tonight, man. Like, just not tonight. You know, tomorrow, sure, but just not tonight. Just don't let it happen tonight. And I turned around and I walked out of that room and I walked into the elevator and I walked downstairs and I walked right up to the guys I was with and I was like, don't ask me to drink with you tonight. I'm not drinking. I've got some stuff going on. I just need to not drink. And, you know, I said it with such conviction. I rarely remember a time up until that point where I ever felt comfortable saying something like that out loud and standing up for myself in that fashion, right? AA has taught me how to have that confidence. But the that was not me, right? That was a higher power helping me. You know, I kind of scared them a little bit. They're like, are you okay? You know, and it was fine. And there was no pressure. And they were all normal drinkers. So they weren't like, we're not going to make you drink anyways. And so, but at that point, I was like, I get it. I get the defenselessness. I get the idea that at some point there's going to be nothing between me and a drink aside from my relationship with a higher power. Right? And so I said, all right, so I'm going to have to get to work on that. So I'm going to read a couple other things here. I mean, we're going to go into We Agnostics in chapter 4. In summary, I'll say this about We Agnostics. This chapter entirely changed my entire outlook on spirituality and the God idea, as they say, right? And when I approached this chapter and started to read it with my sponsor, you know, in all of my newcomer wisdom, I was like, well, we can just skip this chapter because I believe in God, you know? And he was like, how about we just read it anyways, pal, you know? And it was there that I learned how to develop a relationship with a higher power. But the thing that really stuck out to me as a reminder of that is at the bottom of that page, there's a paragraph there. It says, if a mere code of morals or better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many of us would have recovered long ago. But we found that such codes and philosophies did not save us no matter how much we tried. Okay, and then it says, lack of power was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live. And it had to be a power greater than ourselves. And then And I'm not going to read this whole paragraph, but then it just says this line, and I say there's things in the big book that I feel are just nestled away that I won't notice unless someone points them out to me, like my sponsor did. They wrote, well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself which will solve your problem. They just told us why they wrote the book, what the book is about. I would miss that if somebody didn't point that out to me. I'm just not that bright, you know? And that's it. Now, the reason I read those paragraphs is because the one about a code of morals or a better philosophy, if that's all we needed, right, then we would have recovered from alcoholism long ago. There was a gentleman who once told me that to the untrained eye, the cure for alcoholism can look like normal living, right? Stop drinking, go to a couple meetings, clean your house. And I don't mean clean up our side of the street in the steps. I mean just clean your house or your apartment, right? Make dinner at the same time every night. Maybe find a significant other, maybe get a pet, maybe start working out, right? Maybe do some of those things. And that you'll think that if you start doing that and living like a quote-unquote normal person, that everything's going to be fine, right? And so they had to smash that. It's like they knew that that's the loophole I was going to try and find. And so they smash it right there. And they say that's not the case. And then they tell you, lack of power is your dilemma. And I'm like, well, that sounds scary. How am I supposed to solve that? And they said, well, that's exactly what this book is about. And then for me, they smash the entire religion thing and the rest of that paragraph when they say, like, look, we're going to talk about God. You know? They're like, it's going to happen. We've alluded to it in all the pages before there. Power greater than ourselves, higher power, spiritual experience. But they haven't said a whole lot of the word God in there until they get into here. And then they say, we're going to talk about God. And then, you know, plain and simple, cards on the table. We're going to talk a little bit about that, but it's not going to have to be the God that you grew up with or the God that you might have been exposed to or you might have grown up thinking was just the way things go, because you just, that's the earliest memory I have, is going to church with my dad on Sundays, right? Doesn't mean that that's the only God that there is, right? But I'm going to have to pony up, and I'm going to have to, I always say I'm going to have to front the money. And what I mean by that is I have to show myself to God before God shows himself or herself or however you to consider it to me, right? I have to front the belief. I have to believe that a power greater than myself is going to restore me to sanity. I have to say, yes, I'm on board with that. And then I have to start turning over my will to a God as I understand them. And I have to accept the fact that when something happens throughout the course of a day, that's exactly how it's supposed to be, right? So I have to put up the chips in that way. And then I'll be shown the right thing to do, and I'll be shown God working in my life, and that's how I'm going to be able to develop a relationship. It doesn't work the other way, right? This isn't a non-negotiable type of deal, right? Like, I work in a job where we do a lot of negotiating, right? And this is a non-negotiable type of deal. God's not like, hey, I'm going to just show myself to you so that then you can believe, right? I have to put the work in first. And that was the main way that I found myself able to accept that. If you think about going through a given day, right? Every single thing, if you think about it, and I don't do this with any real consistency, but if every single instance or interaction that you have in that day, imagine if after it you just said, well, that's God's will. And that's what I was trying to do at that time, right? Like, spilled coffee all over myself. Well, that's God's will, right? Didn't make the yellow light. Well, that's God's will. Maybe I would have gotten in an accident if I got through the light, right? I don't know. But that's what I had to do. I had to accept and turn it over. You know, because I wasn't running the show very well. And then there's the last couple here that I'll mention as we go, because I know we're coming up on the time soon. But the bottom of the page, the paragraph here, it's the longer one I'm going to read, is much to our relief, we discovered that we not need to consider another's conception of God. Our own conception, however inadequate, was sufficient to make the approach and to effect a contact with him. As soon as we admitted the possible existence of a creative intelligence, a spirit of the universe, underlying the totality of things, we began to be possessed with a new sense of power and direction, provided we took other simple steps. We found that God does not make too hard terms with those who seek him. To us, the realm of the spirit is broad, roomy, all-inclusive, never excluding or forbidding. To those who earnestly seek, it is open, we believe, to all men. Right, so I got to get to know God. Right, I've got to try to build this relationship. And as they say in some of our other literature, the hoop is not the hoop's a lot wider than you think. right? Which means that there's an opportunity for me to still build a relationship and not try to, you know, square peg, round hole this thing, right? I don't have to try and force myself into something. I could take the opportunity to learn and grow. You know, and the last couple things that I thought about in here is that I had to look at other people and what they were doing and see the proof in them so that I could then find my own belief. I sat in rooms like this where everybody had a God of their understanding and they said they turned it over and they said they believed, and I thought, I'm sure none of you gathered 30 minutes before this meeting and said, it'd be really funny if we all told Chris we believe in this, right? Like, so I was like, they're not putting me on here, right? Like, they all have this belief and this understanding. So if they can do it, I can do it, right? I can turn it over and I can try and believe. And the other thing that really helped me was the idea, and it's in here in the pages somewhere. I want to see if I see it here, but I don't. One of the things that's in here is it uses the line about how hard did we really try at spirituality and seeking and turning over to a power greater than ourselves, right? Like, for example, I was an altar boy in Catholic grade school, and I did it because it was something to do during church. It made the mass go faster because I was moving around doing stuff. When you do weddings and funerals and stuff, they'd let you out of class early, right? Like, I wasn't doing it because I was trying to develop a connection with that God, right? Or youth groups or things like that that I joined when I was a kid. I'll be very frank, I did it because it was a place to go on Sunday night where you can meet girls, you know? And it was just this idea of how hard have I actually really tried to turn my will and my life over to a power and care of God as my understanding? And how much was I just going through the motions in those environments to serve my own personal selfish motives, right? And it was at that point where, you know, my sponsor and I got down on our knees and we said the third step prayer. And all of the desperation that I had led me to have the willingness to get into those places and do those things and just put in the work to turn it over. And then we did that, and he did the same thing they say in this book, which we're going to get into next week, is he said, next we launched out into a course of action. He said, immediately, right? We got up off our knees, and he told me where to go buy a notebook, you know? And that's where my desperation started to turn into inspiration as we went on a fact-finding mission about ourselves that we'll talk about in next week. I'm sorry I went a couple minutes over, but I'm going to stop there, and thank you guys for letting me share.